Back to Frankenmuth and more of the Frank Beckman Show on WJR. Brought to you this morning by the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Once again from Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum, here's Frank.
Oh, the stories. They go on and on and on. The gentleman across from me, well, there are two of them here. One of them is the most recent Medal of Honor recipient. And he has a story to tell from the Vietnam War in 1967, where he flew a Huey helicopter that was a harrowing ride that belongs in a theme park somewhere, because he bounced and bounced and bounced along a dried up riverbed. He had his fellow soldiers clinging to the landing skids in some cases, and he got them all out. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, who was a recipient of the Medal of Honor from President Barack Obama. What an honor, sir. Thank you for all that you did, and congratulations on receiving the Medal of Honor.
Well, thank you, sir.
It's I just can't get over the story that I heard last night about how you saved so many of our soldiers. How do you describe it?
Well, that was the mission.
That's just simple.
Just do it.
So what happened exactly?
What happened? Well, the entire mission went from about 0900 to about 1900 or 7 o'clock in the evening. The part that everyone seems to be wrapped up in is the last phase of it, which was an emergency extraction of the remaining troops. We had initially, over four lifts, put in a total of about 160 troops. By the end of the day, there were only 40 remaining out of that 160. And plus, there were four crew members that belonged to my platoon. They had taken a mortar round on the mast of the helicopter, and it was destroyed in the LZ, burned to nothing. So they were down there too, and the only thing they had, for the pilots had, was a 38 revolver. Not much of a weapon against a North Vietnamese battalion size military. And the unit I was assigned to, 176th Assault Helicopter Company, had only one remaining D model helicopter lift type available at the time the battalion commander, or brigade commander, I don't know which, requested an emergency extraction of the remaining 44. operations coordinated with a sister company, the 161st, to get five helicopters to augment my one, and I was to lead and pull out the 44 men. We rendezvoused in the immediate proximity of the LZ landing zone, and went on in to pick up the 44. We went in trail formation because the terrain and such. The shortly after touchdown, the crew from the last helicopter advised that all were on board. Mm-hmm. So I gave a thumbs up to my co-pilot and to take it out. And but I had only one ground troop on board, plus, of course, the crew of four. We climbed out toward the west and then started a climbing turn back toward base, which was Duck Pho, and there was medical facilities back there to take care of the wounded. At about 1,200 feet or so, and not too far away from where the troops had departed, we were headed back over the same general area. The CNC, or the command and control helicopter, someone in there, whether it be the brigade commander or battalion commander, I don't know which, advised that eight troops were still in the LZ. They had been putting up a last-ditch effort to defend the troops that were loading but did not get up to a helicopter. So
they were sitting ducks.
Yes. Eight troops against a battalion. And so I simply advised or let the battalion commander or whomever know that I would go back in to pick them up, not knowing exactly whether that helicopter could possibly get that many, total now of nine troops, because I never had anything. We normally operated with about five or six troops in the D model.
Well, you had no defense against the North Vietnamese fighters who were going to be attacking you as you flew in to rescue these men.
Well, no, because the Air Force had left and the artillery had shut down. The gunships had gone home. I mean, everyone thought the landing zone was clear. But it couldn't retrieve them. So, anyway, the only thing I really had in my favor, I guess, if there be any, would be the element of surprise.
Hmm.
I turned the rest of the flight over to number two with instructions to take them back to Duc Pho and the medical facilities adjoining. And I told them that I would simply break off. When I got a beam, the landing zone again, I would break off and go back in and pick up the eight.
I tell you what, Lieutenant Colonel Kettle, stay right there in the middle of this mission going back to get the eight. I got to take a quick break right here. It's our contingency that we have to follow, and I promise we'll come right back and continue this incredible story that made its way around all of Vietnam. Just wait. There's a lot more to come in this story, and you're not going to believe it, my friends. Here on the Frank Beckman Show.
Now from the LaFontaine Ford of Gladwin Weather Center.
Push it to about 65 this afternoon. Partial clouds, beautiful drive home, and then things start changing tonight. Late night shower, thunder shower threat, 53, but a better chance, better coverage on thunderstorms tomorrow afternoon, 75. From the Weather Channel, I'm meteorologist Ray Stajicon, News Talk 760 WJR.
Right now, 50 degrees.
Some give all.
Back to Frankenmuth and more of the Frank Beckman Show on WJR. Brought to you this morning by the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Once again from Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum, here's Frank.
The nation's most recent Medal of Honor recipient is Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, who is in the midst of telling us the story of the eight men in Vietnam. Everybody was leaving, and there was supposedly nobody left behind on the ground back there, and they said, whoops, we've got eight that are stuck, and the North Vietnamese are attacking with a battalion. They're kind of outnumbered. What do we do? And Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettle said, I'll take care of this, basically, and I got this. So he flew his helicopter back to go get them, and what happened?
Well, I was in the left seat where I normally sat because, and the reason for that was that the chin bubble was clear on the left side, so I could see through the chin bubble better. And the other pilot in the right seat had been flying it at that point. I simply took controls because I could see the eight men down on the ground. They had nothing for cover, but anyway, they were in the clear, so I rolled it over into a left descending steep turn, 90 degrees, and offload the blades so it falls like a rock. And touched down in the immediate proximity of the eight remaining, and we were probably on the ground no more than about 4 or 5 seconds maybe when our friends up on the hill dropped a mortar round off the nose of the thing, which took out part of the windshield on left and right, took out part of the chin bubble, and did additional damage, but I still had a clean instrument panel. I didn't have red lights, so it was still operational. Of course, those troops loaded very rapidly, as one would expect, and then I turned the controls back over to my co-pilot. I say co-pilot, he was he was an instructor pilot, warrant officer, which is a technical, they're technically probably more qualified than the rest of us, but anyway, gave him a thumbs up. We crew chief said that they're all on board, and he picked it up, and it began to fishtail back and forth.
Oh, lovely.
Pardon me?
Lovely.
Yes. Well, and I learned later that in that process, one of the troops that had just loaded got thrown out through the left side and caught the skid on the as he went out, and his buddies brought him back in again. But anyway, at that point, I took control of the helicopter and was fortunate enough to be able to stabilize the thing. But it didn't have sufficient power to pull all those people out of there. So it's not a storybook departure.
No, as a matter of fact, from what I'm told, you basically did the bunny hop step right through that dry riverbed. You were bouncing off of the ground, up and down. And
well, pretty much, because what I need to do is I need to get the helicopter into what we refer to as translational lift, where you have clean air over the blades. In a hover, the air flows up around the blades, and you can hover, but it's not going anywhere. But anyway, as soon as it rolled forward with RPM, soon after pulling pitch, getting it up to just to get it above the ground, and the RPM on the blades began to dissipate because the engine won't sustain that load. So moved forward probably 5 knots or so, because I need about 35, 40 knots, somewhere around there, mm-hmm. if it's going to go at all.
Right.
And I wasn't sure. And then, of course, the RPM dissipates as we move forward. And there's no point in pulling more pitch because it's only going to aggravate the situation further. So we lower the pitch, let the nose skid, the skids touch the ground and get my RPM back up again. Then again, trade that for forward speed. And so I'm going down the riverbed and probably 5 or 6 times trading rotor RPM for forward speed and then putting it back down again to regain my rotor RPM. So probably 5, 6 times down the riverbed. If it was going to fly, it would fly at that point. And it did, of course, as we well know. So
unbelievable. Mike Cox is here as well, Vietnam veteran, 101st Airborne medic. You heard the stories about what they did.
Yeah, we had some interchange with the 1st Brigade guys going up there to serve and coming back. And at some point, and I don't remember exactly how we heard of it, and actually that was very meaningful to us, even though we're in a different brigade a long ways away.
Meaningful in what way?
Well, you go into combat with several, I think, rather normal fears. Fear of being killed.
Sure.
After you're there a while and see combat, your fear, big fear, stepping on mines, losing limbs. But alongside that, very closely, was the fear of being captured and being stranded. And that is a very real fear. And so you... Because we knew what would happen. We had already been told what had happened to previous members of our unit, and I had seen some of that. And so I knew that was not, you were not going to be around long. And so and most of us, 19, 20, 21 years old, that's not, to have someone risk their life to come back in, we had heard some of the details of it, and yeah, we thought, wow.
I tell you what, we have to take another one of those breaks. We got to get to the bottom of the hour news here. Can I impose on both of you to stick around? Because I can't get enough of this story and what you've done, and I think it's inspirational to a lot of people listening right now. I'd like to ask you both to stay if you could.
Sure.
We'll do that.
Sure.
Mike Cox and Medal of Honor recipient, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, whose family had a great, great lineage within the military. We'll talk more about that coming up as well here on the Frank Beckman Show.
Over hill, over dale, we will hit the dusty trail, and those caissons go rolling along.
Back to Frankenmuth and more of the Frank Beckman Show on WJR. Brought to you this morning by the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Once again from Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum, here's Frank.
Dick Hafner, you mentioned this is the anniversary of the Doolittle Raid in Tokyo. It was 3 years after that that the Enola Gay dropped the atom bomb in Japan on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Here at the museum in Frankenmuth, one of the people who is honored in the 175 displays is a gentleman by the name of Robert Schumard from Detroit. He was a flight engineer on the Enola Gay. And among the articles that are on display in his case is his flight cap. And he has handwritten notes on the flight cap, including first atomic bomb that is written on the side of it. And you get chills when you witness this stuff and view it. It's remarkable. But a Detroiter was the flight engineer on the Enola Gay that day.
I can't wait to go there and see all this.
You just have to see.
Yeah.
We're in the midst. We interrupted the story from Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, the most recent Medal of Honor recipient who rescued so many of our forces from Vietnam. And Mike Cox is here from the 101st Airborne, a medic who heard the stories and helped in so many different ways over there, and also has come with a memorial of his own today to the museum. Tell me about what you brought, because that one display has 131 names on it from 1968.
Well, I was asked to kind of to give some of my my uniform and whatnot here maybe a year or two ago. And I thought about it, and it's really not about me. The men that I knew and that didn't come back and that I met their families, some of their families after, how do I remember them? And I wish, which is not possible, that others could have known them and known what we lost. I think I'm very confident we lost many of our best. And that was just my way. I brought a couple of in today to personalize it, a couple of plaques. One is when I was standing at the moving wall and looking up names, and I'd stand there, and I know anybody in the that was by me would say, why is he standing so long? What is he thinking? Well, those were some of the things I was thinking, the events and actions and even sometimes words. A medic is kind of unique in the service. In combat, you're dealing with the end result, which may be horrific, and sometimes I would be with them and hear the last words. Mm. I can still yet visualize on many of the ones that I worked on exactly where the injuries were. I think probably quite accurately, you know, even describe where they were hit and why it was fatal. And so I've only been to two reunions. It was 40 years before I could make myself go to a reunion. And they talked me into it. It was in Ardmore, Oklahoma. And I drove out there very reluctantly. My wife, she was a big encourager, but people had heard that I'd be coming, and I was told that there were numerous family members flying in to speak to me, and that was actually what got me over. That motivated me to drive the last 100 miles. I was in Oklahoma City, and I had 100 miles to go. That's a very difficult 100 miles for me to drive in, and so there were numerous families there from different events and from whatever that I ended up speaking with, and I seen the and heard the other side of it. You had to know humanly it was going to be there. When the notification officers came to their door and give them the notification that their son had died or their husband or their father or whatever, and that there'd be a funeral with all the family members and the grandparents and whatnot there, because most of us were very young. And so it was, you know, most of us were 19, 20, 21 years old. So it just became, this is an effort from me, and I really don't know how to do it. I tried to imagine, what is it like with somebody coming through and just seeing a display? Okay, they can see a picture of me and when we were on a mission or whatever, but that's not important at all to me. The important is for them to ask the questions, what would it be like if I had got the phone call or if they drove up to my door, or what were these people really like? So I listed in the one some names of men that I remembered very well, and I could have listed many more names, but to try to get them to just stop and think.
Yeah. I tell you what, we need to take a break for traffic and weather. I want to introduce Brandon Minnith coming up, U.S. Navy SEAL and Vice President, Board of Directors at the Museum, when we come back. And we'll have a special online today, Major General Mary Link celebrating the anniversary of the Army Reserves as well. That's going to be a web special here on the Frank Beckman Show. Stay tuned. Be right back.